Hello and welcome to another exciting season. That's right, season of Modern Day Philosophers. This is season 5. And it is the season for some great talks and some wonderful guests. I'm very excited for you to hear. Today, I couldn't be more excited to kick off the show with my guest Colin Quinn, who is one of my favorites. He is a great, great man. He is a great comedian. I don't know why I've turned Scottish for the intro, but I'm very excited. The Scottish is coming out of me when I get very excited, and you can hear it. And I'm not gonna go on for too long. I want to get to the show. Our sponsor today is another great man. He's a wonderful man, Mr. Dan Schlissel from Stand Up Records, who put out my record, Some Kind of Comedian, available on Stand Up Records label. And here's a few words from them.
You know, here at Stand Up Records, when we say we have the best names in comedy, we're not messing around. In fact, we were there first, with comedians who went on to become household names. Names like Hannibal Buress, Maria Bamford, the Sklar Brothers, Doug Stanhope, Mark Maron, and Lewis Black. So why not head on over to standuprecords.com or amazon.com or the iTunes Music Store and pick up a classic CD, DVD, or download of the best comedians working today. And check out some of our other artists, because you never know who the next big thing will be. That's standuprecords.com.
All right, there you have it. Go to the website, moderndayphilosophers.net. Make a donation, please. This show is heavily supported on your donations. In other words, I am supported by your donations. And if you make a donation of $20 or more, guess what? I will send you some Tweaked Audio earbuds. That's right, compliments of the good folks over at tweakedaudio.com. If you're new to the show, welcome. Welcome and thanks for coming. Lots of good shows there in the backlog. I hope you check them out. Some of them are funny. Some of them are serious. Some of them are serious and a little funny. Some of them are funny and a little serious. I think they're all pretty good and pretty interesting. And I implore you to check them out. I beg. I'm not going to beg. But if you want to check them out, I'd appreciate it. All right. I'm in a good mood today. Let's rock and roll on with the show, huh? Shall we? Here it is, my talk with Colin Quinn in his apartment after he'd injured his knee and he was icing it. But he still, the show went on. Colin did not say, don't do the interview, I hurt my knee. He said, come over and do it. What a guy. I gotta say, I have so much respect for Colin Quinn on so many levels, and what a wonderful, nice guy. And here he is, the legend himself, the one and only Colin Quinn, right after the intro song. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
All right, test. How you doing? How you feeling?
Well, right now we're sitting here. I'm icing my leg. We're watching the Jets game. And that's really about it. I mean, you know.
Tough to watch the Jets. I used to like the Jets for a little while when I was a kid.
Yeah, it is tough to watch them.
The Jets, they always let you down. The Mets always let you down. And the Nets used to always let you down. I don't know. I think the Nets are doing better now, right?
Yeah, the Nets. No, they're not. And, you know, it's funny because people always said about the Jets, you never bet on the Jets. You never bet against them and never bet on them because either way they'll let you down somehow.
You mentioned before the show, before we started recording, that you get bored with sports these days.
I do get bored with it, yeah.
When did that shift start?
I feel like it happened. I feel like stand-up comedy is all-encompassing in some weird way. Like, no matter what I'm doing, I'm thinking, shouldn't you be writing a stand-up thing right now? Like, I just love it so much, too much.
Really? So any time of day you feel that's what you should be doing?
Yeah. It's a psychological problem, too, because you feel like, yeah, but I'm not really doing it correctly. You know what I mean? Like, you always want to be like, that's not it. There's a better joke. It's better. There's a better thought. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. What do you think drives that?
The reality, which is that it is true. And also that we're lucky enough to do it when, you know, there always is something better. And we're lucky enough to do something that when you get older, you don't have to stop doing it. I'm watching the Jets. They get like 10 years. If you're lucky, you get 10 years. And then you look back the rest of your life. Oh, if I had only done this exercise, if they'd only had that training or that operation around, I could have been, you know what I mean? Like, with a very few exceptions. You know, you're like, no, that, if only I'd, I should have done that. That, or just that one move you make that destroys your career, that one, you know, where you're an exhibition. That's always the saddest part of sports to me, is the plays that don't count, the exhibition games, practice, and you get hurt for life, you know?
I wonder where, for some people, it goes away. I spoke to Robert Klein recently, and I asked him how often he writes. He says he doesn't write anymore. I said, why? He says he doesn't feel like doing it anymore. He doesn't want to. But at some point, I think everybody is where you're at right now, where I've been on and off, where you get this complete and total drive to just, you have to jot everything down. It's all very important.
Yes, it's all very important. That's how I feel. Exactly. I'm like, nah, there's something there. And the sad part, the part that about me that really is deluded probably, and maybe you're like this, maybe every comedian's like this, is I'll look back at something I wrote like 3 years ago, like some little note that I thought was so brilliant at the time, and I'll look at it 3 years later and go, that is brilliant.
I'm the opposite way.
Really?
Yeah, I look back.
I rarely look at something and go, that was stupid.
Yeah.
I go, oh, that was a good one. No wonder I saved that. That makes it even more. I'm like a pack rat. You see, I'm almost like a half a hoarder.
I look back and I go, what was I thinking?
No.
That's no good.
I'm just the opposite. I'm just like, oh, gold. Gold, Jerry.
But sometimes I'll look back at it and I'll say, oh, I see what I was trying to say there. I had it all in the wrong configuration. Yeah. I wasn't articulating the thought clearly.
Oh, that happens to me, yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
That too. But either way, I'm never like, oh, what a stupid, unfunny thought, ever.
That's great.
That's
very positive thinking.
I know, it really is. Well, I feel like to be a comedian, you have to be an optimist. Because you're getting up there every night going, hey, folks, you know what? This is where it's at. Me and my thoughts are going to make you laugh. Watch this. You know what I mean? So that is an optimistic... It is an optimistic business, even if we can be negative. It's very optimistic.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like comedians are as negative as everyone, as we like to think we are. I don't feel like comedians are as dark as they and everybody else likes the narrative to be, because it's very romantic to think that way.
Uh-huh.
I don't buy it.
It's like a Hemingway type, everybody wants to be.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't think Hemingway was that dark. I feel like Hemingway led most of his life partying away, drinking, whoring around, going to bullfights, going hunting. And then when he found out he was sick, he killed himself. So suddenly that makes him dark.
Why do you think it's romanticized to be dark?
Because there's something about it being haunted that's romantic. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, everybody feels haunted by certain things. I mean, life has its regrets to it. You know what I mean? So, I mean, there is a certain, but there's something romantic about seeing somebody and going, do you see that man? He used to be this guy, and then the love of his life died, and he, you know what I mean? It's just got that romantic image to
depth.
It.
Depth. I think that's
depth is also, yes.
People want depth. They're like, oh, this guy is deep.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't feel the way he feels.
Right.
You know? And I think the flip side of that is this sense of wonderment. If somebody, like, I think with Andy Kaufman, it's more about, oh, he had this childlike wonderment. There was a magical quality, right? It was almost... The opposite.
Yeah, I mean, Andy Kaufman pissed me off sometimes, but, you know, like, I mean, I never met him, but I mean, like, I liked him, but I also felt like, what's he saying, you know? Like, sometimes I was like, he's showing, telling people milk and cookies. I mean, I get it to an extent, but if I was at a show and somebody read The Great Gatsby, I wouldn't see the absurdity of, like, what are you showing about the world? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I'll tell you what else. I just thought of this second. Andy Kaufman was reading The Great Gatsby. Where did Andy Kaufman grow up?
Great Neck.
Great Neck.
Great Neck. Right.
Where does The Great Gatsby take place?
Great Neck.
Great Neck, Sands Point.
Uh-huh. So he's just reading a local book.
He's reading a local book that he's interested in. But if he'd read that book and then said, I'm from Great Neck and blah, 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 that would be different. But just to read it without doing the second half, I feel like it was a little bit indulgent. I mean, I realize calling Andy Kaufman indulgent is not the most... You know, he'd probably be like, yeah, dummy, that's what I'm trying to be, indulgent.
Does it bother you if a comic is wasting their potential in front of you? Is it?
Yeah. I feel like we all struggle. I feel like comedy, nobody's figured out a system yet. You know what I mean? And people go, that's how comedy should be, of course, you know. Mm-hmm. Once again, the romantic narrative, but maybe that is true in comedy. Like, you know, like in acting, there's classes you can take. Now, you can take comedy classes and learn, but you can't learn the thing that's really hard to learn. Like, nobody's come up yet with a system, here's the thing. Nobody's come up with a system like, if you write like this, perform like this, and do this, you can be, that's the basic system that we all know works. Mm-hmm. Nobody's done that. And here's why it makes me laugh. Because it could easily be done. It's not because we can't be corralled and mm-hmm. we're too wild. It's because we just don't give a shit to do it. It's like, and if somebody came along and said, hey guys, what about this system? We go, fuck him, he's not even that funny. I'm not going to, his system stinks.
Maybe that's why it works, you know?
What works?
Comedy, because maybe it is a social rebellion on some...
Yeah, that's a good point.
So,
yeah,
if you conformed, someone would have to break that, you know?
Yeah, it is a social rebellion, you're right. It's exactly what it is.
Yeah. What do you think about it being a social rebellion appeals to you?
I don't know. I don't feel like I'm particularly angry. I mean, I don't like society like any other normal human being. It's not like anybody walks around going, oh, the world is, society's great. The whole world hates society. So, I mean, it's not some... The status quo is to hate society and complain. Mm-hmm. It would be the edgy move would be to go on stage and say, guys, everything's great, and here's why. Uh-huh. Hey, my life is good, your life is good. You know, I mean, obviously I'm kidding, right? Because that's not funny. It's not funny when people say, the world is great.
You know what? Maybe that is the thing about Andy Kaufman reading The Great Gatsby. He was acting out. He was pissing people off.
He was.
So maybe a great part of social rebellion is just pissing people off, and it's not necessarily important how.
Well, I disagree, because I think that part of being a stand-up is you actually have the power. You have to elicit. I think that any stand-up that gets up there it's not about Andy Kaufman. It's just anybody that gets up there and goes, you were talking about comedy philosophy. Mm-hmm. I feel like anybody gets up and goes, I'm a comedy philosopher. You better be getting laughs. Because if you're not getting laughs, you're not a comedian. Mm-hmm. You may be a philosopher. You may be brilliant. I doubt it, but you may be brilliant. But don't advertise yourself as a comedian so that people come out expecting to laugh, mm-hmm. and then they don't get laughs. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'd rather see a hack go up there and go, I'm a comedian. Even though I don't buy him as a comedian, I'd rather see a hack than somebody go, hey, the audience can't handle me. You know what I mean? Because at least he's doing what he advertised, even though it's doing it, in my opinion, a low-life way, he's getting laughs.
It seems like you're upset because of false advertising, almost.
Yes, exactly. I don't want people using my profession, comedy, and then going, hey, man, they just couldn't handle me. It's like, that's not what happened. You're not funny. You're not being funny. You might be funny, but you're not doing your job.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the whole point of a comedian is whatever message we give, which I'm all for, the more of a message you give, the better. The more of whatever you can bring to it. But if it's not in joke form, then why are you saying you're a comedian? You're a philosopher, you're a preacher, whatever you are, but you're not a comedian.
I used to see certain nights Patrice O'Neill would like to walk the room on purpose. You ever see those nights?
Yeah. I love Patrice, and I love him because he's funny and he's got a great mind. But if I saw him walk the room, I would not, you know, like I said, there's this myth, in my opinion, it's a myth. There's this myth, this romantic narrative of this middle class Americana that needs to be shaken in their boots by these edgy people. You know what I mean? Yes, in 1958, when Lenny Bruce did it, that's exactly who existed. But nowadays, I don't buy it as much. You know what I mean?
I remember one night at Stand Up New York when he'd pissed off the crowd and he just decided, let me just keep going and keep going. And as they got up and left, he said, good, get out of here. And then he'd just keep going and going. And I kind of saw that as The Great Gatsby, you know?
Yeah. See, but I don't consider that part of comedy. That, to me, Patrice was brilliant because he wouldn't walk the room. And he would just tell them how he honestly felt. And he would make it into funny bits. Mm-hmm. And like, that were different, you know, that was an angle you were like, I mean, on Tough Crowd, I mean, you want to talk about it, spoiled. I spoiled him every Tough Crowd episode because he would get up there and he'd start talking. I was like, oh, I know where this is going, so I'm going to cut it off. You know, he's talked enough. The rest of the cast, nobody else has spoken yet. We've been on for 10 minutes. And then he would just take it to another angle, and I was like, all right, I got to hear where this goes. Because he was so funny and brilliant, and he always had another angle underneath where I thought he was going.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what's brilliant about him. Walking a room doesn't impress me. Because guess what? The unfunniest comics in the world I've seen walk rooms. Open micers walk rooms. So walking a room doesn't mean anything to me.
How often do you see yourself grow as a comic? How often do you look back and say, all right, I'm now on another level?
Well, I never say it out loud. I mean, I won't admit to it. But I mean, it's definitely happened. It's probably happened 4 times in my career. 4 times where I go, oh, shit, I'm doing this now. But then, of course, it always ends up where, like, 2 years later, you're like, what am I doing? And, you know, I've been talking a lot about lately is that feeling you get. Like, if you're up there, you could be killing. And you're like, I'm so great. I'm great, man. Everything I write is funny. And if you have a set where there's no laughter and you're bombing, everything you say sounds like, that's not a joke. These people are 100% right. That's not a joke. I have no jokes. I'm just a talking, clever ass. I've got nothing. Like, just that feeling, too, you know?
Yeah. And then at a certain point, you feel like when you do talk like that and it's not jokes and it's killing, you're like, I've transcended jokes. You know, I think there's...
Right, right, right. There's all kinds of levels where you're like, yeah, I'm now at the point where I'm as funny. I'm exactly what everybody in comedy strives for. The guy that's as funny at the cocktail party as I am on stage, just regaling people with my spontaneous stories.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working off And then you go back the next night and you're like, That's the beauty of comedy. It's one of the greatest reality checks ever for show business. Like, nobody else has to deal with that. They don't get instant feedback.
Mm-hmm.
These people came out to laugh, you know? Right. Now, I'll blame some of them. Believe me, I'm not giving the audience a free pass. These drunken assholes and fucking idiot dick joke lovers. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying that, in general, people are out there to laugh.
I wonder if it's just me with a delusion of grandeur, but sometimes I feel like there's going to be a moment where I'm going to break through, like the Matrix or something. I'm going to break through this thing that this comedy, there's sort of like a barrier that I just hit and hit. Do you get that? Like, I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna get through, and I'm gonna be that other thing.
What's the other thing?
I don't know.
But who's broken through it?
I don't know either.
I don't know.
But maybe, I mean, that's what makes me keep trying to do it, you know?
Yeah, but I don't believe that could ever happen. I believe you break through levels of your own thing to levels, but I don't believe there is a barrier, because I've never seen anyone who can get up and start talking. I'm talking about night after night. Start talking about what happened that day and just be hilarious in joke form. It's never been done. So, I mean,
maybe that's the thing.
That's the Matrix. Where you can get up and talk about the last hour before you came on stage and do an hour about the last hour you just spent in your life before you came on stage and then do it. You know?
It's like you almost want to touch that ultimate truth. If I could just touch it.
That's why people do crowd work. Because crowd work is ultimately as close to spontaneous comedy, because you're working off the actual moment. But, you know, it's still a different thing from what we're talking about, which is a fully formed act based on the last day or whatever hour.
Well, all right. Let me jump into this philosophy with you. Alex picked a guy who even I've heard of this one. His name is Dante, and I don't know if I'm going to say that right, the last name correctly, Algieri.
Dante Algieri.
Dante Delgi Algieri.
Ooh, che fa?
Here's what you have in common with him, and maybe the Catholic thing too, but he says, Colin's become a master of storytelling through his one-man shows, and he talks about the people that history remember. So here's a philosopher from the Middle Ages who theorizes on immortality through storytelling. One of the themes in Dante's Inferno is how we can make ourselves immortal through storytelling. That's a bit repetitive, but when you recount somebody's story to another person, it creates a legacy for both the character of the story as well as the storyteller. This is why Dante and his story is asked by people in hell to tell their story to others, so they might live on somewhere besides hell. Dante takes opportunities to tell some of their stories, mostly as an excuse to spread his legacy. However, ultimately, fame does nothing for our present condition, as is lamented by the souls in hell. While fame can be fleeting, we must try to get it, because otherwise no one will care about us.
Interesting. I like that. Oh, I like that quite a bit.
Yeah, what do you like about it?
I like the fact that it's sort of saying like, you've got to go for it, even though it's bullshit.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely justifying fame.
Right.
Right.
It's justifying, but at the same time, it's acknowledging it's bullshit.
Yeah.
But it's saying, hey, you know, it's the only way.
It's important for that reason.
It's saying bullshit is the only way. So I like that. That's pretty honest. Hey, bullshit's the only way.
Do you think part of what you're doing is trying to be immortal?
I mean, I feel like when I'm doing stand-up comedy, like, I would like to be immortal, but I don't feel like it's going to happen. But I mean, I would love it, because it's so amazing to be immortal, immortalized. But I mean, I do feel like when you're on stage doing comedy, I do feel like there's moments of God in the air with you in the audience, in the energy. I feel like there's moments. I feel like that's why comedians are addicted to it. I feel like there's God moments.
Can you elaborate on that a little more?
Just that feeling. There's this feeling that I can't articulate that must be God, because there's something in the air between the laugh and the and you're not there for the money, and they're not there for the, you know, whatever fame or whatever other bullshit. It's just suddenly everyone's just got in this kind of mood together. And it's a combination of you and them. And I feel like stand-up is such a combination of the audience and the performer, like nothing else. And you've got to be in something together. And I feel like those are God moments, when people are in together with each other.
Do you talk to God ever?
No.
You never pray or anything like that?
Well, I pray sometimes, but you know. Yeah, but I mean, I don't talk to God, no.
When you pray, is it a religious thing or is it a personal thing?
It's an Islamic thing, and I know that's controversial right now. I pray for ISIS, you know, that their caliphate may be victorious in northern Iraq. No. It's pretty personal. Like, I mean, it's not like I'm asking for things for me, but maybe sometimes I am. But you know, no, it's more religious, I guess, in the sense it's more of a big scheme thing, you know, than it is personal.
What things outside of comedy are important to you?
I mean, I don't know, the world. I feel like, you know, like everybody else, I just feel like the world is like, you know, you always feel like, oh my God, it's brutal. How could it keep happening like this? You know, it just makes you depressed, you know?
I know.
Like anyone that doesn't believe in God, I'm like, yeah, I hear you. I don't blame you one bit.
What's the
it's
distinction?
It's easy not to believe in God. There is no distinction.
What keeps you believing?
I don't know. I keep believing, because I feel like it's like that Pascal's wager, whatever it is, where you might as well believe.
Yeah.
You know, because like it's almost like that with me, you know? Like, I just believe, because if you might as well believe or not believe, I'd rather just believe, just because, you know what I mean? And I do feel like there are moments when I go, oh, that's God. Like I said, sometimes on stage, or sometimes the energy in a room, I go, that's got to be God. That can't just be, you know, and intelligent design, it's a little too intelligent for me. Like it was almost pieced together a little too well for it to just be a random series of evolution. You know what I mean? Like, I believe in evolution too, but I believe evolution started with, you know.
Yeah, I'm the same.
God. Yeah. So it's like, you know, God gets a bad rap, believing in God nowadays. It's not, you know, basically because of all those, the crazy fundamentalist type people, you know, they won't believe in evolution. They only believe in God. They believe, you know, in the literal interpretation of the Bible, but there's a lot of people in the middle, you know.
Kylie and I drove here, and we passed through some you know, some of the worst neighborhoods in, not the worst, but some of the worst neighborhoods in Brooklyn.
Right.
And we both get very depressed going through those neighborhoods, and we were discussing why. And I,
because you took Atlantic Avenue.
Yeah, but it's like you go through and it just looks like sadness and poverty around you.
I know.
And you're like, oh, that's a shame. And it's only a few minutes away from the good stuff.
Yes.
Know? So, and as soon as you go through it, you're like, oh, this could be me. I could wind up here.
Sure.
You know, so I don't know. It's very tough.
It's very tough to believe in God with all the horror that goes on.
Yeah, you got to just keep justifying somehow. Well, I guess it's okay that they live. We were talking in the car. We're like, well, maybe they came from Haiti and it was worse there. So this is a step up in objective versus subjective realities. So maybe this looks like Disneyland to them. You know?
Right. I mean, yeah, it's very tough. It's very tough. No, I mean, it's impossible to figure out what it is that that makes it, you know what I mean? That makes it, that may, because it's, but it's, maybe it's the definition of God is like, I mean, what they always say is that more will be revealed when we die, because obviously we don't know. You know what I mean? Like, we don't know what, so obviously God is not about justice in this world. Anybody that thinks God is about justice in this world, there's too much evidence that says that's not true.
Yeah.
You know?
But I do find it fascinating how everything sort of fits together. It all works together. Like,
yes, exactly.
Things hit me, weird little things, like just about rice. You know, there's so much rice.
Yes.
Never think about how every culture loves rice.
Yeah.
You know, there's chicken soup and rice for the Jews, or the Asians like rice, or the Indians like rice, and the Muslims like rice. Everybody has rice in their diet.
No, Italians don't.
Well, they have risotto. It's close.
I mean, Irish don't. We don't have anything on diet, though.
The Irish got fucked on the diet. They got nothing.
Well, they got potatoes, I guess.
Why did they not? This is just maybe a historical thing that I don't understand. But wouldn't, in the potato famine, why didn't they? They're on an island. Why didn't they just go for fish for a while?
Yeah, no, I know. I've heard that theory, but it's really complicated. In those days, you couldn't get to the. There were no fish on the coast of Ireland. I don't know why.
Were you raised in the Catholic Church?
No. No, my parents were more like George Carlin. Like, they were raised in a Catholic church, so they didn't really push us to. Although two of my brothers and sisters went to Catholic school, but they went more because public school was wild. And they liked Catholic school, you know what I mean? But I think my parents were, like, anti-Catholic and anti-church because they were raised that way. And then as they got older, they kind of mellowed. My mother goes to church a lot now, but, yeah, they were more like they called. That's why when I did George Carlin was on Tough Crowd, and when I did it, I invited my family, and I was like, I didn't even think about it at the time. My whole family showed up, all my cousins, everybody, my uncles, my aunts, all showed up because of George Carlin.
Because you feel like they connected to him on a whole nother level.
Yeah, especially the older ones definitely connected to him on a level. Because, I mean, I thought they would show up, I guess, but, you know, we all listened to those albums.
Yeah.
We would listen as the family would let. And it made us laugh because we're like 14, like, cocksucker motherfucker. And, you know, he's doing the act. And we grew up in New York, so we understood. We went to church sometimes, and some of my cousins went to Catholic schools. So we got it.
Mm-hmm.
But they got it on a whole nother level.
What?
He freed more Irish Catholics by letting them laugh. I mean, talk about a comedian doing something.
Yeah.
He articulated all of their... in a humorous way. He didn't do it by just... I mean, later on, he started going, the church is fucked up. But that first Class Clown I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That was his third album, I think. But that album liberated so many people through laughter that it was unbelievable.
That's fantastic.
Because you could see how gentle he was in that album, too. Like, he's going, you know, it was a sin. He's describing all the different sins and describing all the church. And you get this priest... and then you get the Father Rivera. And he just went through all of these, you know, the novenas and just everything and confession. And he did it in a very gentle way at that time. You know?
I like the way you put it, gentle. It was in his tone, there was a gentleness.
In his tone, exactly.
Listen, it's okay.
Right, you know? Right.
It was like it lulled you in a way.
Yeah. Like, and he's like, it was a sin to feel up Mary Ellen. It was a sin to want to fill her up. It was a sin to fill her up. It was six sins in one feel. And like, I was just, that was such a, that's a great example of comedy that I got to see personally liberating people, which was to say all these Irish Catholic parents and adults that were just like, oh my God, I'm not crazy. The church was screwed up. And you know, then later all his anger came out.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's fine. But that particular example has always been I mean, Class Clown is my favorite album of all time, you know.
Was it strange for you having family in the audience when you did your show? Did it ever
No, I'm so used to it now from being from New York. So it doesn't bother me anymore. Like when I first started, I was like, oh, family. I'm so used to it, I can't even be affected by it.
I never let them come because I can hear their criticisms in their head as I'm doing it. I don't even want to have that.
Yeah, but everybody, you know what I mean? It's like you can't manage these things. You know, you can't choreograph these things too much. Because you know what? Every time in comedy, I was like, oh, I wish I was going to go on then. Maybe I could switch spots and go on to the perfect spot. That spot sucks, and the other spot would have been great.
Yeah.
And it's like, same thing. I wish I could organize who's in the crowd. If I got that crowd, that's my crowd. Mm-hmm. That crowd sucks. Just let it happen. You know what I mean?
Well, I think Letterman, to this day, doesn't let his family in the audience.
So. Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah?
I think it's weird. Unless your family's going to be drunk and throw bottles at you and start fights. You know what I mean? Just let it go. Who cares? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He can't control shit, you know? I mean, he can. Obviously, he does.
You think the less control, the better?
Yeah.
I think the more you try to control stuff in life, the more disappointed you wind up.
Yeah, and the more it gets out of control anyway, you know? You can't overly control things. You just have to do what you do. You can control what you do, and that's it.
I've learned that as the years have gone by.
Yeah.
I really feel nowadays it feels better not to want to control a situation.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you're with a few people, they want to do something, you want to suggest something, fuck it, we'll do that thing. I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't even want to try and persuade everybody otherwise.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And going back to the rice, the example, okay, so most people have rice. I'll edit it.
Okay, most people have rice.
But you never see these rice patches anywhere. You know, they're all in China or something, but we've got so much rice coming in all the time.
Right.
I'm always just amazed how they control the rice. And rice is so hard to control. If you have a packet of rice.
It's all watery.
Well, even just the dry rice. I open up a little box, it gets all over my kitchen, and I got bits of rice there for 3 months.
Right.
Before
right.
I find them all.
You're right.
How do they control all the rice? How there's not rice just on the sidewalks when you walk down the street? There's so much rice going around.
You're right.
To me, that's like the most amazing thing of how the universe has got some order to it. We can control rice.
Yeah, well, I mean, that sounds to me like, you know, this sounds like something deeper than just, you know. I mean, you're acting like rice is overwhelming us left and right, and suddenly you're having dreams about giant rice patties attacking you. You're like, rice is everywhere, and we can't. I feel that way about rats, by the way.
Yeah.
The fact that those demons have not surfaced and tried to take over. Just imagine I'm running into this city all the time. It drives me nuts.
You want to clean it up?
One for each person.
The rats don't bother me as much as the rice. I just can't understand how we control so many millions and billions of pieces of rice constantly around us, and we don't have to see rice.
No, that's true. We don't see rice. But I guess in Vietnam and China, they probably see rice everywhere.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, it's in water, isn't it? In like swamps?
Yeah, I think it grows in rice paddies. But I just mean spilled rice you don't see. You don't see too much rice. There should be rice chaos.
Well,
by
I
now.
Mean, you mean like a truck that's delivering rice turns over and.
So, yeah, it should happen all the time where bags of rice should be pouring out. I mean, there's so much rice around us all the time. We shouldn't be able to walk one block without seeing rice.
Well, but I don't know
rice.
If that's because of nature. It seems like it's man that created these great rice packets and. Cases that hold rice without spilling it.
But what about the people who take the rice out of the restaurant? They're walking with the rice and
who
they get bumped.
Who walks around with rice?
People walk with rice. The halal stands on every corner here.
There's rice in halal stands?
Yeah, there's rice in halal stands.
I haven't seen that. I didn't know that.
That's the main thing, rice, and then you pick a meat.
Oh, yeah, of course. Good point. I was only thinking in terms of old school like Chinese, but now you're right. Halal. Oh, well, that's a good point.
Anyway, just an idea. All right, I'll read you a little bit about Dante here. Durante degli? I don't know. You know Italian?
Dante what?
His real name was Durante Delgi.
Dalgieri.
And they simplified it. They just call him Dante.
I suggest you try that, too.
He lived from 1265 to 1321. He was a major Italian poet of the Middle Ages, and his Divine Comedy. Let me stop and tell you about the Divine Comedy. The Divine Comedy is an epic poem written by Dante between 1308 and his death in 1321. It's widely considered the preeminent work of Italian literature. The poem's imaginative and allegorical vision of the afterlife is representative of the medieval worldview as it had developed in the Western Church by the 14th century. It helped establish the Tuscan dialect in which it is written as the standardized Italian language. It is divided into three parts: Inferno, which is the first part, and then Purgatorio and Paradiso. I guess that's purgatory and paradise. I don't know Italian, but I can put that much together.
That's right.
On the surface, the poem describes Dante's travels through hell. Oh, there we go. Hell, purgatory, and heaven. But at a deeper level, it represents allegorically the soul's journey towards God. At this deeper level, Dante draws on medieval Christian theology and philosophy, especially Thomistic philosophy and the Summa Theologica of Thomas Aquinas. Consequently, the Divine Comedy has been called the Summa in verse. I don't know what the Summa is.
The sum of everything.
Okay.
No?
Probably.
I don't know.
Makes sense. The work was originally simply called Commedia, and was later christened Divina by Giovanni Boccaccio. I can never say the names. Dante was born in Florence, Italy. Nobody knows exactly what the date of his birth was, but it's generally believed to be around 1265. He was a very political guy. He was, I'm not reading that quote, I'm just skimming it.
A very political guy.
Very political guy, you know, he got involved in politics. He fought in the Battle of Campadilio.
Let me read it. Jesus, look at all these apothecaries' guild. No wonder you can't read this nonsense. He was embroiled in the Guelph-Ghibelline conflict. What the hell is that? The battle. He fought the Battle of Campaldino with the Florentine Guelphs against Arezzo Ghibellines. Oh, I see. It was like two of those families, like the Borgias and the Medicis, I guess. See, it's so funny. You never know any of these. Look at this. He was among the escorts of Charles Martel of Anjou. Really, who cares? While he was in Florence. That was one of those facts that, like, Wikipedia, like, the nephew of Charles of Anjou probably just put that in at the last minute. He became a to further his political career, he became a pharmacist. Why would that statement go without an explanation?
I guess the drugs control the people.
Oh, you had to be enrolled in one of the corporazioni dell'arte del mestiere. So he got into the Apothecaries Guild.
That's a pretty good guild.
Oh, and books were sold from apothecary shops. So as a politician, he accomplished little, but held various office. Oh.
It's always interesting when you look into the lives of these people. You know,
Yeah, although the split was family lines, ideological differences arose based on opposing views of the papal role in Florentine affairs, the Pope, right? With the blacks supporting the Pope and the whites wanting more freedom from Rome. The whites took power first and expelled the blacks. In response, Pope Boniface planned a military occupation of Florence. City's governor treated the Pope's ambassadors badly. Dante was one of the delegates. Oh, the Pope dismissed the other delegates and asked Dante alone to remain in Rome.
And I was skimming that, and that kind of screwed him. Because then everybody, right? Then everybody thought that he was trying to defect from them, but he was just following orders.
Oh, yeah.
So I wonder if it was a setup.
Oh. And they said he was an absconder. Yeah. And he wouldn't pay, and he was, this is a complicated story. Oh, during his exile, he did the comedy.
Those are usually the best times for writing comedy.
Oh, yes, during exile.
He was alone. No distractions.
Well, how do you like that?
Have you ever read it?
No. Did you read it?
No. I wonder if it's funny.
It sounds like a real pain in the ass to read, but yeah, I'm sure it's great. I've never heard anything bad about it. It would be worth it just to read because nobody else alive probably read it. Like back in the old days, like the Founding Fathers, you know, the whole... I guarantee they all read that. Mm-hmm. Now you can just reference it and, you know, two obscure nerds will know what you're talking about and everybody else will be like, well, nobody would ever deny you.
Uh-huh.
Florence, Mother of Little Love. That was with... It was dedicated on his grave. Mother of Little Love.
Sometimes I think, wow, what a great reference that would be. But if nobody knows, it just becomes like a Dennis Miller bit. You know?
He died of malaria at age 56. You son of a bitch. I'm 55.
Well, I'm not saying you're going to live the same life as Dante.
Yes, you are. You just cursed me. The Guelphs and the Ghibelline.
Oh,
the Battle of Campariani.
I hope you outlive Dante, man. I hope.
Hey,
that...
man. I hope you outlive Dante, bro. Yep, that's it.
If not, you better make it count, you know?
Yeah. So, is that it?
No, there's a little more.
Oh, go ahead.
We have some of his stuff here. Usually I ask the guest to read it, but since you read that, I'll read this. And then we'll discuss it. Here's a little bit of his work. Lying in a feather bed will bring you no fame, nor staying beneath the quilt. And he who uses up his life without achieving fame leaves no more vestige of himself on earth than smoke in the air or foam upon the water. Still talking about just basically...
Fame. This guy's fame obsessed.
Yeah. But he did it. He got famous, and we're still talking about him.
Yep.
That kind of proves his point.
Yeah.
If he wouldn't have had the fame, he'd just be another unknown author from the time.
That's right. Doesn't sound very spiritual, though. If you're not famous, you don't leave anything but his... What the hell kind of spirituality is that?
But it is kind of that way with religion. I mean...
BS.
Right? I mean...
No. You could, for that matter, you could say his mother wasn't famous, but she brought him who brought... Who left the vest, you know what I mean?
Well, you don't have guys like Moses or Jesus or Muhammad, then what do you got?
Then what do you got? You got those guys, what do you got? You got nothing.
I mean, you got to have somebody to attribute it to.
Well, I feel like that quote, I feel like Alex phoned that one in.
Yeah, you should have picked a better quote.
Yeah, that had no depth. I think Alex is trying to attack me for wanting to be famous through his stupid Dante attack. He's made it all about Dante's fame obsession. And he's really just attacking me, Alex.
You don't seem like a fame-obsessed guy to me. Am I
wrong?
No,
I'm not. I mean, I like, you know, I like to be known. I mean, I want people to listen to what I'm saying. But it's not like I want to be, you know.
You're not chasing, like.
I'm not chasing it through any means necessary, obviously.
Why is it?
I think I've proven that.
Why is it and why isn't it important to you?
Well, it's important because, as the great poet once said, the great Italian poet, without fame, you're a whisper of smoke. But I mean, it's important so then people will listen to you. But if you people listen to you and you're so busy chasing fame, you have nothing funny to say or nothing good to say, then they're listening to shit and you feel like shit. See, that's the short version.
Have you seen, what's the negative sides of fame that you've experienced?
Your ego gets out of control. That's the biggest negative, your ego. You know, my ego, everybody's ego. When you get well known, you start going, oh, yeah, I did something. No, you didn't. Just do your work. Get up. That's the biggest thing. It affects everybody a little bit, you know.
Do you ever get down on not being more famous? Do you ever get caught up in that?
Yeah, all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm surprised to hear you say it.
Well, you want me to lie and say, no, man, everything's cool.
No, I want the truth.
It bugs me because I want more people to listen to me, you know? I became a comedian, so the more people that listen to me and laugh and go, that's right, the happier I am. You know what I mean?
What if it was? What if you knew that the you'd get a lot more people, but they wouldn't be quality people, or you could have a small.
Or
group
they'd
of
misunderstand
really high...
what you said. Yeah, I'd rather the small, obviously. Then, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying, yeah. No, I mean, obviously the odds. You know, people get more famous. It sort of dilutes things in a certain way, but you still want more people to go, oh yeah, he is right. Maybe you're saying he's right and we're wrong. I don't know, but yeah.
Is it kind of a strange thing to walk around and people know who you are, you don't know who they are?
No, I'm so used to it now. It started for me so long ago with MTV, so, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Now then it was only people under 21, but it was still a thing that it's been such a part of my life, it doesn't even affect me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just part of my life, so it doesn't mean anything to me at this point. It's been 25 years, and I was on MTV 25 years ago, so
wow,
this is my life, you know?
Yeah.
And like I say in my act, I'm famous, but nobody cares. People are like, hey, Colin, help us hold up the hood while we look. There's something wrong with the carburetor.
Because you seem very down to earth. That's you. Yeah. You don't have this air about you like, I love Jerry Seinfeld, and I don't know him at all. I know you're buddies with him.
Yeah.
I've seen him a million times at the comedy clubs, and I sat next to him at Lucian's funeral, and I've never said a word to him because he has this kind of air about him that's like, don't talk to me. Feel it, so I don't do it.
Yeah.
But you don't have that. You feel, you know, I'm...
Some people say you should have that to be successful. I'll never forget, I was talking to this guy who lived in Hoboken, some Italian guy, and he used to know Jimmy Roselli. And he goes, I go, well, he has good voices. Frank Sinatra. He goes, better. He had a better voice. And I was like, oh, he goes, he was the most amazing singer I ever heard. I go, that's great. So I figured he's a Roselli fan. I go, why didn't he make it as big as Sinatra? And he got a disgusted look on his face. He goes, because he never acted like a star. You'd see him sitting down next to you in the deli, shoveling a sandwich in his face like a gavone. You got to act like a star if you want to be a star. Like he was criticizing a guy that he said was a better singer than Sinatra.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that story. Because he never acted like a star.
I guess there's so much importance on that, you know?
According to Dante, there is.
Yeah. It's funny, you know? What makes you decide you just rather just be yourself, I assume?
No, I just, you know, there's always something. Like when I was growing up, when you'd watch like the Oscars, like De Niro and Dustin Hoffman and all these guys in the 70s, like they would never be like it was like, oh, you're going to be like those phony, like, hey, how are you, coming out all dressed up and how are you? Fantastic. You know, like the Rupert Pupkin just got back. There's something about the role, you know, like to us, that was like, oh, that's like tacky, you know what I mean? Because we'll used to like dusting up, and if they show up at the Oscars, they're not going to wear a tie. Uh-huh. And nobody made it, you know, send up somebody to collect it for you, you don't even show up. Mm-hmm. So like that whole school of 70s, like, you know, like corduroy jacket, you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. loose kind of look. I like that influenced me more than I realized, you know?
Yeah.
So that getting too dolled up, it just feels weird, you know. It feels like, oh, that's not that's an old showbiz to me, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, like that's from another time, but you know, there's obviously ways to do both or play one and still underneath, you know. Mm-hmm. It just feels something about it just bothers me. Yeah,
it doesn't feel real. Maybe
no, it doesn't. It's not real, but you know, it's just like false humility. That's why on Twitter I'm always doing, you know, that false humility.
Yeah.
It just bugs me. It bugs me.
Yeah.
And people are like, nothing bugs me more. This is what bugs me the most when I think about showbiz. Nothing bugs me more than somebody, and it, look, 100 great people have done it. But then people showing up. I was at an award show. I'm seeing stars everywhere I turn. If you're like a sitcom third lead, yes. Otherwise, these people, I'm saying, shut your mouth. Shut your mouth. I don't buy it. That's what I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Something about it's a phony to me. Like, I see all these stars. Like, I'm just like, you people, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're in show business for a reason. We're trying to be in show business. Don't act like, hey, I don't know what the heck I'm doing. I'm just floating along. You're busting your ass just like me and everybody else.
I think it's any time I detect something that doesn't, that I feel like they're trying to pull something over me, you know, that gets me angry. I guess that's basically what being a comic, to me, that's what it is.
In my opinion of comedy, of course, for what that's worth, is seeing the bullshit and everything, but seeing the bullshit in yourself. You know what I mean? Because we're all capable of false humility, too, and we're all capable of all this other shit that I criticize. Mm-hmm. So it's like, that's what a comic to me is. My favorite comedians are people that say, yes, here's what goes on in the world, and here's what goes on in my world, which is also bullshit.
Yeah.
And the people who try to act like, oh, I don't know, you know,
Otherwise, you're just pointing fingers at everybody else.
Exactly. And you're the fucking one, you're saying to the crowd, like, hey, we're not like that, right? And everyone's like, yay. Typical bullshit.
Yeah. All right, we got three quotes to round off the show here. I don't know if that's the right word, round off the show, but to end the show.
Okay.
I got three quotes, and usually I'll ask the guest to read them. Would you do the honors of reading these quotes?
Sure, I would. There is no greater sorrow than to recall our times of joy in wretchedness. Well, does that mean our times of joy when we're in wretchedness? Like when you're doing terrible. Yeah, that's what it means. When he's locked up, mm-hmm. when they banished him, he's recalling the good times. Right?
And he's saying there's no greater sorrow than that?
Yeah.
So I guess it just rubs it in even more.
Right. I would say there's no greater sorrow than recalling our times of wretchedness in wretchedness.
Yeah.
Well, we'll go on. Worldly fame is but a breath of wind that blows now this way and now that and changes name as it changes direction. Well, that's making him sound like he doesn't believe in fame. Well, I guess he doesn't, but boy, he was really about fame in some ways, or else Alex is, like I said. Art, as far as it is able, follows nature, as a pupil imitates his master. Thus, your art must be, as it were, God's grandchild. Now, that's a good quote. Now, one out of three is not bad for Dante. Art, as it is able, follows nature, and as a pupil imitates his master. Thus, your art must be, as it were, God's grandchild. So he's saying art follows nature, nature is God.
There's that God in the moments of comedy.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's what it is. It's when you're doing what you're meant to do. And like I say, comedy to me, meant to do and depth, doesn't mean just talking about, you know, the CIA, you know, and, you know, that's part of it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Sometimes significant things are in insignificant statements, sometimes insignificant things. We've all seen political thinkers / philosopher comedians who are like, hey man, the government says this. And it's like, okay, but we've heard that for 30 years. What are you saying to contribute beyond that?
Yeah.
Kind of vague statement of, you know, authority is bad. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just saying you're anti-authority is not deep.
That bugs me too. That bugs me.
Of course.
Like crazy. So all these comics that are quote-unquote edgy, social commentators, and they just going up and...
Yeah, you're not going up against Putin in Russia.
Yeah.
Nothing's going to happen to you. So
you're just saying what we already know, and hopefully, you know, they're relying on some people in the crowd that are like, oh, I'm glad he said that, you know?
Of course. Like I said, applause is not laughter.
Yeah.
So if you get applause... You may be a great public speaker. You're not necessarily a comedian.
Right. Well.
Well. I guess that's it.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, I'll be honest, though. I was kind of hoping that when we read this Dante thing, I'd be so inspired to read Dante. And now I don't know that I am. It was always a hard thing to read anyway, let's face it. I've read some of these circles, you know what I mean? They're beautifully written, but it's hard. I may have to investigate it now.
So maybe you are inspired.
Maybe. But it sounds hard. It sounds like it's too much fame stuff, but maybe I'm meant to do it. After all, is Alex ever wrong? Has he been wrong so far?
Not usually.
Then he won't be wrong now.
You got to read it.
You know what I mean? I got to read it. And I don't even know who Alex is for all of you listening.
I want to know if it's funny.
Look. I bet it's funny. I think I remember some of it being funny, like the circles of hell, like some of the people who are in there. Like in one section there's these idolaters and this other section is, and it's funny because I've been working on this thing on my side for my stand-up comedy, which is a list of assholes. So maybe if I put it in that, so it's all the different types of people in the little passive-aggressive things they do.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a way to put those into the seven circles of hell that I think they would belong in.
You think?
I believe in hell.
You do?
Yes. You really? I believe in heaven and hell.
What do you think it's like?
Hell? I don't have to worry about what it's like. I believe in heaven and hell and purgatory. Why? Because it makes sense to me. You can't just get away with being a goddamn Hitler on this planet and then you get the same burial as me for eternity. I don't fucking like that and I don't buy it. I guess I could have used somebody nicer than me as the other alternative to Hitler. How about Hitler and Mother Teresa, maybe? I don't know.
I like that you didn't think you were too far enough away from Hitler in the example.
Well, you know what I mean? Yeah. It has to be somebody
that's
like,
humility right there.
I'm at the other end of the spectrum.
Oh, man. So every action, you do really feel like it's all accounted for somehow.
I hope it is, yeah. And I believe it is, but I hope it is anyway. I have no proof. Except for Dante.
Why continue living? Why not? You know, I think about Robin Williams a lot these days since he killed himself.
Yeah.
Why not? Why not take yourself out?
I mean, of course. There's a good argument can be made to take yourself out. But I'm saying, you know, I don't know. I mean, I just see people, when they know they're going to die, they struggle so hard to get a few extra years in that I'm like, there must be something to it. That, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because people just hang on when they really, you feel like, why wouldn't they just die? So there must be something great about it. You know what I mean?
Just these two great comedian deaths so close to each other, and they were just total polar opposites.
Yeah.
Robin could have lived for a long time, and he took himself out, and Joan was like fighting for every day, and she didn't want to go anywhere.
You're right. So there is no God.
Or it's more complicated than that.
Right. Yeah.
I was supposed to talk to Joan while I was here.
Oh, no.
And I was excited to ask her why is she so driven to do so much, you know?
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. I'd like to know that.
That was my main thing on my mind.
I'd like to know that, too. I like to know if it's about being relevant or if it's about money or if it's about really trying to get that joke, that matrix thing you talk about.
Because
I'm not saying there's a matrix, but there's elements of levels. So I wonder what her thing was. I feel like Carl and it was levels and trying to get his point across. But I feel like there were levels there, you know what I mean? With Carlin.
Yeah, he was definitely, if you look at his work, it gets deeper and deeper as it goes.
Yeah. The only problem with George Carlin, in my opinion, is, which once again, the balls even say it, but is that he didn't work out enough live. So when he came out, he was so brilliant that he worked it all out alone, and then he'd go out. But if he had worked live all the time, there was something else there. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like there was too much alone time.
Interesting.
You can see it in his work, you know, in my opinion. You can see this brilliant, brilliant, brilliant work, but you need the audience to take it to, like, he might have gone, put it this way, I feel like if anybody had the potential to do the Matrix thing, it was him. And the reason it didn't always happen was because he wasn't out live enough. He was as close, you know what I mean? He was as close as we'll come to that guy, that Matrix. But again, I don't know what it was. Maybe it wasn't the dates. Maybe it was not listening to the tapes or not listening to the crowd. But there was just one thing, but he was so on the verge of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a filter thing, I think. I think a lot of the difference in different comics is how controlled they are. How controlled they are with the message. It's just about, you know, people talk about Robin Williams. He was so unfiltered. You hear the word filtered a lot in comedy.
Yeah.
It makes you think, you know. We have these filters, and just how much do you use them? Seinfeld, very filtered, right?
Right.
The unfiltered is glorified, but I don't think it's necessarily better than the filtered sometimes.
No, Carlin. I think there's so much to be said for both of it, but for both of it. I feel like you have to, I feel like ideally you would start from filtered. Well, like anything else, you start from filtered, then let it be unfiltered, then listen to it and see where you've.
And then refilter.
And then refilter and then re-unfilter. But ultimately end on the second unfiltered. Yeah.
It's like a water purifying process.
Yeah.
All right, well, thanks so much for doing the show, Colin.
Thanks, Dan.
I appreciate it. All right. That's our show, everybody. I want to thank my guest, Colin Quinn. I want to thank you guys for tuning in. ModernDayPhilosophers.net is the website. Please go and make a donation. Or if you're interested in sponsoring a show, you can always email me at thecomical@yahoo.com. That's thecomical at yahoo.com. And you can also email me there just to say hello. I'd love to hear from you. I really would. Any feedback is welcome. And if you have particularly good feedback, please don't hesitate to leave it on the iTunes page. They have the ratings and reviews page. And if you leave 5 stars and a nice review, it helps the show. It costs you nothing. And it puts good energy out there into the universe. And it keeps me excited and energized to do this show. And it helps in a lot of ways. So please do that. Okay, everybody. Have a great week. And I'll see you next week with another episode of Modern Day Philosophers. Thank you. Goodbye.